Good morning, everyone. We're going to go ahead and call to order the Senate Committee on Judiciary. Thank you for being here this morning. We have two bills that are scheduled for public hearing. One of them is public hearing and possible work session. I've looked at the list of registered witnesses. I think what I'm going to do is go ahead and open up public hearings on both of those. That will allow those who are wanting to give testimony on both to do so, and so I have to seesaw back and forth. And when you do that, if you can just tell us which one you're testifying on, and then when you shift to the other one, just denote that. That way the record will be a little clearer. So with that, Eric, why don't you give us openings on both?
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, Senate Bill 822 comes to this committee from Senator Cruz, Representative Williamson, Senators Boquist, Gelser, and Representative Krieger. The bill requires the recording of grand jury proceedings and establishes procedures for disclosure to the parties and the public. Senate Bill 825 comes to this committee from Senator Thatcher. It grants a defendant a right to appear and testify in grand jury proceedings. There is one amendment that slightly limits that right to situations in which the person's been arraigned on a charge and has counsel. We don't have financials on either of the bills.
Okay. So at this point, we'll just be doing public hearings today on both of those. What I'm going to do is I'm going to take the elected officials, since they need to move to other committees and other assignments. So Senator Boquist, Representative Williamson, Representative Krieger, if y'all three would be so kind to come forward. And I don't think there's anyone else in the way of members that are here.
Start. Ladies first.
You want me to start? You want
to start? We're starting out here.
Okay.
Oh, that's fine.
Okay.
Okay, so.
You're right.
Boy, this is a cool. I could do it in two groups.
That's right. Krieger's going to get
take
up and run away.
I'm
going to
take
so.
Off in a second here.
Okay.
Sheriff Pavansky, for the record, Wayne Krieger, State Rep, District 1. And I'm going to be talking just very briefly about 822. I do have to get down the hall here. I gave a lot of thought before I can decided to jump on board this, but I feel with the passage of Measure 11, the whole subject of plea bargaining has been causing an imbalance in the justice system. And I've talked to the judges about that. I've talked to different district attorneys about it. And I don't think there's any doubt that that's happened. I believe that Senate Bill 822 will allow the defense attorney to better understand what and who testified before the grand jury and basically what was said, and have him have a better opportunity to make the proper defense for his client. I believe there are 37 states that have had similar legislation. Also, Senate Bill 822 has explicit as to who may have access to those grand jury recordings. That's all I have. Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
Would it be all right if I leave?
Yes, sir.
I've got a couple.
I'm looking around. I'm looking around to see if any of my other committee members would oppose it. I don't think so.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair and member of the committee. My name is Jennifer Williamson. I'm the state representative for House District 36. I wanted to take a moment to talk generally about grand juries. You should have in front of you a Brennan Center for Justice article that was just posted. A couple of months ago, and I think there's a map coming around as well. So I want to start out by talking about some bills that we've seen in this session and a theme that I believe we're seeing in public accountability in the criminal justice system, whether it's body cameras on police officers. We talked about yesterday in the House Judiciary Committee, collecting data on racial profiling, and other bills that are all about I think the public's reaction to things that have been in the news. You know, we've all heard about Ferguson and in New York, and that sparked a conversation nationally about grand jury reform. And it's interesting, in the Brennan article from the NYU School of Law, they call out Oregon as having the dubious distinction of being one of only three states that relies on handwritten notes of a juror as an official record. And you'll see in that map that I handed out that we are light blue, and it says that recording in some cases for grand juries in Oregon, they're calling recording the handwritten notes of a grand juror. So that I think that's a great visual comparison of the states and to see what an outlier we are. So This, I think, is a bill that takes the first step in grand jury reform in Oregon so that we can actually participate in the conversations about grand jury reform nationally. Since we don't even record, we don't know what we need to be doing in grand jury reform. I want to make a couple of comments about why I think the bill as presented is the appropriate way to deal with what kinds of cases we record grand juries. I think that we need to ensure that all Oregonians who have their case brought before a grand jury are given the exact same process. I think having recorded grand juries in high-profile cases or use-of-force cases means that we're cordoning out special potential defendants who are getting more process than the average Oregonian. And I think that flies in the face of the kind of transparency that we've been talking about in our committees this session. So you will hear today that this is an expensive proposition. And I don't believe that's true. We're waiting for a legislative fiscal on what the fiscal impact of this will be. There's no, we have not gotten any indication from them yet what it will be, but there will be numbers presented today that that are not the ones that I've gotten in Ways and Means yet. We're waiting for that. So as soon as I get that, obviously we'll get it to the committee, but I just wanted to make sure that you knew that in the Ways and Means process, we don't have an official number on this bill yet. Thank you.
Good morning, committee. For the record, Jeff Cruz, State Senator, Senate District 1. Keep in mind, I'm just a simple country boy and don't understand a lot of this stuff. When I was approached about this subject, I thought it made perfect sense to have an actual recording of grand jury testimony, especially in light of what's gone on around the rest of the country. And I'm looking at it as a way to actually back up what district attorneys are doing and keep them from being the bad guys in the system. Now, having said that, Mr. Chair, I think we still have some issues yet to deal with. One of the issues for me was how you proceed with discovery and what's available to who at what point in time. Especially, you know, I mean, we could focus on whether it's all only when there's a true bill it's available or when or various other applications. We've had conversations about the matrix going down so far when all this is, you know, whether it's just Measure 11 or all crimes. These are the sorts of discussions I'm hoping we can continue to have and come up with something that's reasonable. But quite honestly, Mr. Chair, from my perspective, and clearly I think judicial discretion is going to come into play as some of this as to what can be released to who. And I'm fine with all of that. I just think in light of the events that are going on around the country, and the need for transparency, the fact that there is an actual recording of the proceedings rather than just notes is the appropriate thing for us to do. The details we still have yet to work out, and we are more than willing to sit down and work those out. But I think it's time for us to step up and do what most other states are doing at this point in time and have an actual record of the events in the grand jury. Keeping in mind, Mr. Chair, that this isn't for the public, okay? In no way, shape, or form is it going to be for the public or for the media. This is for the principals in the case to have access to information that may be appropriate. For example, if somebody who testified before the grand jury is impeaching themselves in open court, I think that's an issue that should be addressable. So, like I said, hopefully we've had several work group meetings, and I imagine we're going to have several more before we're done. But I think this is an appropriate step and move forward for the legislature at this point in time.
Thank you.
Ladies first. You're an 825. All right. Whoops. Hello. Wasn't going to sing a solo here. All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Council. I appreciate the opportunity to speak on behalf of Senate Bill 825. Real simply, the bill allows individuals accused of a crime.
Need your name on the record.
Oh, sorry. Yes, I have done. It's the first time I've done this.
About all right.
Senator Thatcher from District 13. And well, anyway, Senate Bill 825 just allows the individual who is accused of a crime to testify before a grand jury and give relevant, competent evidence concerning the charges that are brought before them. And also, the individual will be subject to questioning by both the grand jury and the DA. The benefits would of the bill, it would give a process whereby, some DAs were allowing testimony of the defendant and some were not. And so this would just allow it at all times and allow a process. And it allows the defendant to testify, and prosecutors are given an opportunity to gather testimony early on in the process, and for defendants, testifying before the grand jury hearing can help head off charges resulting from some sort of mistake or complicated circumstances. They can maybe explain themselves a bit, and ultimately the bill will give prosecutors the ability to get the bad guys a little earlier in the process, perhaps, and allow innocent individuals to explain their side of things before entering into a long and difficult trial. And that's pretty much the sum of it. There is an amendment that just limits it to those who, so that we're not dealing with these secret investigations, that we're not tipping off the bad guy ahead of time.
Okay.
And that's about it.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Senator Brian Boquist, District 12, I'm here in that capacity, testifying on SB 822. I am one of the co-sponsors. This is not quite the oddest bill I've signed on to this session, but I'm approaching this slightly different, I think, than even the chief sponsor here. I look across the system that we have out there, and we legislators to my left and to my right and even on the podium are down there around the level of Congress, and judiciary is just slightly higher than us in the public perception out there. A lot of that public perception is we've seen across the nation in grand jury discussions in the news has been lawyers from either the prosecuting side or the defense side saying XYZ happened, and then the question is whether that really did or did not happen. What we have before you now, Mr. Chair, is a bill that does require the recording, so there is no doubt. It's an equal playing field. It's available to the defense and to the prosecution and not to the public, so therefore, it, in my mind, levels the playing field across the line. It would help in the public's perception out there that it is fair and balanced, even though it's not transparent to them. And as to the present time, I think you know, Mr. Chair, that there's 13 states that do this. The district attorneys in Oregon are at a slight disadvantage on the playing field for the bill because the defense type prosecutors may be working in Oregon, Washington, Idaho, across the border in California, and so they're exposed to the other states and their recordings and their systems over there, whereas the district attorneys we have been practicing here in Oregon. I would encourage the work group that the good senator to my left is talking about to move forward, because what we really need to do is find a solution this session. It's their old adage, you can always lead a horse to water, but you can't make it drink, but we need to make it drink in this session. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Question regarding the map, and it's probably for Representative Williamson, since she presented it. Looking at it, it looks like Iowa's now been made a recording state, but more importantly, there are the states that are listed as optional. Can you give us a little bit more? I mean, is it various to what that means, optional, or is this a lifeline question that we need?
I was going to say, Gail.
I can pose that question later. We'll get the lifeline up here in a little bit. All right. Any other questions for the members? Thank you all very much.
I have one correction to make.
Yes.
That would be an alleged bad guy or girl.
Sounds like
equal opportunity.
Sounds like
Thank
a TV news. All right. So. Yeah, you can, but I'd like to have three other people come with you. Do you need to just have the table by yourself? I mean, it's your day, so.
No, that's fine. I just wanted to.
Well, go ahead.
I'm sorry. I just thought I'd frame the issues, if I might.
And you're going to start with 822?
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you, Chair Pozanski. Members of the committee, Gail Meyer on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, here testifying in support of both Senate Bills 822 and 825. I'll address my comments first to Senate Bill 822, which is the recording bill, and we would like to thank the two co-sponsors, Senator Gelser and Senator Cruz, for being on that bill. The Criminal Defense Lawyers Association has introduced this concept in prior sessions, and to my understanding and knowledge by archiving it, we've only had one other hearing on that. At the time, the bill was phrased that it was the district attorney's obligation to do the recording, and the District Attorney's Association objected at that point, opposed the bill because of costs. You will still hear, I believe, from the opponents of the bill, the district attorneys, that they do still oppose this bill on the basis of costs. The bill, though, is framed differently. The obligation to do the recording is now going to rest with the court. And initial discussions with respect to one-time startup costs to equip the grand jury's rooms around the state is approximately about $250,000. But beyond that, I think you'll hear calculations of cost that far exceed anything that we would agree with. And I hope this committee appreciates that that's a conversation that will be ongoing and under the watchful eye of co-sponsor Representative Williamson. Aside from costs, though, it's really hard to quarrel as to the policy. It's hard to really contend that handwritten notes is going to be a better or more accurate accounting of what was said and done in a room than an actual audio recording itself. I'd like to point out to the committee the federal system had a nationwide 30-year experiment with recording before it chose to mandate recording in all instances. So the federal system started to experiment with recording in the 1940s, and it was in 1979 that the advisory committee to the rules said, this is so universally good for all participants in the system that we're going to mandate it. So that was in 1979. And across the land, all federal courts then started to have audio recording, well, actual court reporter in the room typing the machine. It was in 1982 that the American Bar Association came out with their Model Act, Model Grand Jury Report and Act, that advised that all states go to recorded grand juries. That was in 1982. So here Oregon is 33 years later, now debating whether we're going to catch up to speed. By my calculation, I have read all 50 state laws, and I had originally, by my research, had counted 34 states mandating a recording of the grand jury. This map would have 36. I do note that there are other states where the practice is permissive with the court, and they elect to do so by election. They prefer to do so because it's permissive with the court. Oregon has a feature that I think is unique to any 50 states. Oregon only allows the district attorney the right to request that a recording be made. So our statutes say that when the district attorney requests, the court shall record. The court in Oregon cannot do it on its own initiative. Mr. Chair, you asked questions about this. I can tell you that I don't know that I, by memory, and I don't have all 50 states memorized, but I think that I had would have colored the map slightly differently. I think I thought that Michigan and Texas both had mandated recordings. So I would be happy to take this map and double check it against the research that I've got, which is a Excel spreadsheet of all 50 state laws, and see if there's any variables there.
That would be great. I'd like to also have a little information about the states that are optional, what that really means. And because one of the things that I think that is going to be an issue that's already been discussed is fiscals. And so I'd like to just know what is out there.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll be happy to do that. I can tell you by my memory of having read all those laws, and I've did it more than once, I don't know of any state that limits recording to just certain crimes. They either decide to record or not to record, and different manners of recording and different manners of giving access to the record. But I don't recall any state that divided it based on the type of crime. So I anticipate you're going to be hearing opposition on the following features. One is the crimes to which the recording mandate should apply. I believe the opponents will propose a theory that this should be limited to officer-involved shootings resulting in death. And again, I just articulate that I don't know of any state that would limit the mandate to just particular crimes. A feature of the bill that will also get some attention is the question of who actually does the recording. How mechanically is this going to get recorded? And there will be some testimony from others addressing that point. Our bill was written towards limiting the fiscal. The platinum gold standard version here is to have a full court employee from the judicial system in the grand jury room, either operating a stenographer machine or operating the electronic device. That is a very expensive proposition. There's 47 different grand jury rooms throughout the state. So our bill adjusts that and gives that task to one of the grand jurors. Right now, Oregon law relies heavily on the grand jury for an accounting of what's said in there. ORS 132.080 says, the members of the grand jury shall appoint one of their number as clerk. The clerk shall keep minutes of their proceedings, except the votes of the individual jurors, and of the substance of the evidence given before them. So our current laws say one of you shall take notes, and the purpose of your notes is to record the substance of the evidence given before them. In our view, by converting that person, that minute taker, to someone who simply will operate a machine that would hit an on button and record a ticker number and hit an off button and record that ticker number, is expecting less of that individual than our laws right now, which require them to actually, in writing, record the substance of the evidence given before them. You will hear testimony from a former grand juror whose job it was to take notes and what that meant. And another feature of the bill that I think has drawn attention, Senator Cruz referred to it, is the standard by which a person gets a copy or doesn't get a copy. Our bill clearly hoped to identify and keep very narrow the access to the record. We do feel that there's a legitimate basis to keep grand jury testimony secret and confined. We don't think it should be on Facebook, and we don't think it should be on the evening news. And so the bill identifies the three possible outcomes from a grand jury proceeding. There's the true bill, which where when someone's accused of a crime. In that instance, once the defendant is arraigned and arrested and in the system, the defense lawyer would get a copy of the record, as would the DA. We don't think it should be public beyond that, because whatever happens in open court legitimates whatever had previously happened in the grand jury. Either there's a trial or there's a guilty plea, but you don't really need to flush out and broadcast what occurred in the grand jury. The other outcome is a not true bill. And in that instance, we took suggestions from some. You saw this being played out in Ferguson and in elsewhere, where there were these proceedings inquiring into conduct of officers, and they were not indicted, and then eventually those grand jury transcripts were released. What the bill says now is, in the event of a not true bill, in all general respects, the record is sealed. The exception comes in if there's a proceeding into the conduct of a public servant, and a public servant is identified elsewhere by law, and in that instance, a person would have the right to petition a court for a motion and an order. Your Honor, this was a conduct into a public servant. Could have been an officer. It could have been an auditor of a water bureau, whoever. And we would like to see why that grand jury decided to not indict. So that's the feature of the bill. And then the last feature of the bill is in the instance when it's neither a true bill or a not true bill. Right now, our statutes are pretty clear. It says that in ORS 132.430, in the event that a grand jury does not issue a true bill, then it shall issue a not true bill. But you'll hear testimony that that's not the way things occur. What occurs very frequently, actually, is the district attorneys will present a case, and they will inform the grand jury, you don't really need to come to a verdict on this one if you get stuck. If you start to deliberate and you find that we haven't met all of our elements, you have a question, you think that something's a little funny about the case, you don't have to take a verdict. Just knock on the door, let us know. We'll pull the case, and we'll go back and we'll do follow-up investigation. No problem. This is happening around the state. So as our bill is framed, it doesn't disallow that. But what it says is, in the event that you have a proceeding and then you pull it and nothing occurs, there's no true bill, there's no not true bill, but later you present that very same case to a different grand jury, same criminal episode, same victim, same defendant. If you run it up a second grand jury and you get an indictment, in that instance, the district attorney will have to inform the defense lawyer of the first initial proceeding, and then the defense lawyer will get the transcripts for both. So you will hear a panel of, they'll have three panels. You'll have three district attorneys, former district attorneys come up. They've had experience taking testimony in recorded grand juries of different configurations. Then there's going to be another panel of three former grand jurors, and they're going to tell you their experiences. And then there'll be a subsequent panel of defense lawyers. Addressing my comments now to Senate Bill 825, this is the grand jury target bill. We would like to thank Senator Thatcher for introducing that. Of the two bills, this one is the legitimate reform bill. The other one's not a reform bill. We're just catching up with what everybody else is doing. But this is a reform that's embraced across the spectrum from left to right and in the middle. The right of the target to testify has been embraced by the Commission to Reform the Grand Jury, which was a study done by Congress many years ago in the 80s. The National Criminal Defense Lawyers Association then enacted a Bill of Rights for the Grand Jury, and this was embraced as one of those reforms. Again, the American Bar Association came out with its Model Act in 1982. It embraced the right of the target to testify. The Heritage Foundation has also embraced the right of the target to testify, and U.S. attorneys in the U.S. Attorney's Manual state that whenever there's a request for a target to testify, it should be given very favorable consideration, else it looks as though that there's unfairness afoot. The -1 amendment is what we're looking at here. It has been very narrowly written. There's very little to no burden on the DA. The district attorney does not need to affirmatively go inform anyone of this right. This is limited to people who have already been arrested on an information alleging an allegation, and they're waiting for a grand jury proceeding to occur. In that instance, the defense lawyer can assert the request and the right to testify, and the obligation is that the district attorney attempt to meaningfully, reasonably accommodate their schedule, but in no event do they need to delay grand jury proceedings beyond 5 judicial days. You might hear some testimony that this bill isn't necessary because in all instances, whenever the defense does request the permission to have their client testify, it's granted. You'll hear some testimony from attorneys that that is not the case. I put out the query on the listserv for the criminal defense lawyers, and it was astoundingly coming back, oh no. There are plenty of instances when the request has been made for someone to come in and testify before the grand jury, and sometimes it's allowed, but often it is not. What the general response is a phone call about 3 or 4 days later saying, well, it's too late, we already got the indictment. In one instance, someone said, well, all grand jury proceedings are secret, so I can't tell you when we're meeting. And so there's just not consistency, and what Senate Bill 825 would do would institute some order and some procedure. Thank you. Happy to answer any questions.
All right, questions.
Thank you, Gail.
Thank you.
All right, so I have a sets of panels that have been suggested. So I'm hoping the first one, I can't tell if it's Dan Ramfield? Ramford? Okay, I can't read the first. Is it Dan?
It's Pear.
Pear, okay, sorry. Jason Short and then Steve Wax. I apologize.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Per Ramfjord. I'm here testifying in support of Senate Bill 822. I'm here as somebody who worked as a prosecutor for some years in Washington, D.C., which is an interesting jurisdiction in that all of the cases are brought by the U.S. Attorney's Office. I was an assistant U.S. attorney there, including both state and federal crimes. In that capacity, I indicted hundreds of cases. I ended my time there working in what is called the Violent Crimes Unit, prosecuting person crimes, violent person crimes, assault with intent to kill, assault with deadly weapon, up through second-degree murder. And so I had a substantial amount of experience putting people in the grand jury and seeing how the process worked, also using grand jury testimony, testimony as part of the prosecution. And since that time, I've done a lot of defense work here in Oregon, defending a variety of different kinds of crimes. It's my experience that the recording of grand jury testimony really benefits both sides, both the prosecution and the defense, and it contributes greatly to the administration of justice in the system. For the prosecution, it provides an opportunity to lock in testimony that you want to preserve later on. And, you know, there's going to be some discussion here today perhaps about witnesses feeling threatened or feeling like they're reliving an event if they have to testify in front of a grand jury and it's recorded. In my experience, witnesses found it far more easy to testify in front of a grand jury than to testify at trial. And one of the things that was really important as a prosecutor, if you had witnesses who had been threatened or were subject to threats, they would testify honestly in front of the grand jury. And at trial, they would sometimes back off of that testimony. And to have the opportunity to rehabilitate their testimony by reminding them what they testified to under oath before the grand jury was of critical importance. So it was a great tool as a prosecutor to moving the case forward. You may also hear that there's some concerns here about cost and about how much time is going to be taken reviewing grand jury testimony. And the reality is that as a prosecutor, if you're going to take a case to trial, you're going to want to review that testimony in any event so that you're going to take time to do it. You're not going to necessarily have to take time to review it all if you're just offering a plea or doing things like that. But if you're actually going to go to trial, you're going to review it anyway. So I don't think that it's going to contribute much in terms of cost. In terms of also just one more comment on this notion of being feeling threatened. In the hundreds of cases I presented to a grand jury, I cannot recall a single instance in which any individual who was testifying in front of a grand jury felt that, oh my gosh, I'm going to be recorded. I'm nervous about that. I don't know what to do about that or anything like that. There was that just never came up. So from my perspective as somebody who's done this, I just don't see that as a legitimate concern that causes a problem. As a prosecutor, also another benefit of having this testimony recorded is that if you gave your file to a defense lawyer, they had a good idea of what was going on in the case right up front. And when you're plea bargaining, they know what they're up against. And that could be beneficial in terms of negotiating cases. As a defense lawyer, I've seen the benefits as well. The benefits include the fact that, you know, if somebody's given inconsistent testimony in front of a grand jury and what they give and then testify differently at trial, I can expose that to a jury. That allows the jury to have a better sense of the witness's credibility and what's going on. It's also very beneficial as a defense lawyer to have the case laid out when you're having discussions with your own client. And your client's telling you one thing and you're saying, wait a second, look at what these witnesses testified to. This is what you're up against. Do you understand that? And it will contribute to the ability to actually secure reasonable plea bargains from people for whom that's the best outcome in a case. So from my perspective, I think it's something that I would support. When I moved here from the D.C. area and first learned that grand jury testimony was not recorded, I was shocked because I thought it was something that really benefited both sides. And it struck me as something that should happen. And when Gail invited me to come here and testify in support of this bill, I enthusiastically agreed to do so because as a citizen of the state, I think it would make a great contribution to the administration of justice here. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Who's next?
I think I'll be next. Okay. Thank you, Chair. My name is Jason Short, S-H-O-R-T. And so I would like to address the chair and members of the committee with regards to Senate Bill 822. And is this also the time to address 825
after
as well?
After you finish 822.
Perfect. Okay. So just so I understand. So I'll first address with Senate Bill 822. I just want to reiterate, again, I was a former prosecutor for I started off in the U.S. Attorney's Office as a clerk my third year of law school at Willamette University, prosecuting what their equivalent to their misdemeanors on federal land. And so they would send me to prosecute those in federal court in Portland and also in eastern Oregon. I'd travel there as well. And then the remaining or 7 years or so after that, and that was in 1999, I was a prosecutor and handled approximately 6,000 cases. They gave me a printout of all the cases I'd handled when I left. So I had a somewhat pretty good idea of how many cases I handled. I was in the felony unit for probably at least 5.5 or 6 years, and many of those cases were, they're all felony cases, many of which I handled through the grand jury process.
Which county?
Washington County.
Thank you.
And in that particular county, we had two grand jury rooms, and pursuant to the statute and what Ms. Meyer had already talked or testified to with regards to the procedure was by Senator Thatcher, she has a laptop computer. And so we had the grand jurors, and one was designated as the note taker with a laptop computer. And I guess to reiterate, in any, I can't think of one grand jury that I did where I had a witness say or express any discomfort or nervousness by having someone at the other end of the table with a laptop computer typing and trying to get as much information. Of course, I've seen those notes, and they're not word for word by any means. I mean, they're just, you know, as quickly as the person can type, and sometimes maybe their typing skills aren't up to par. But again, they volunteered to kind of help and try to get as much information as possible from the witnesses testifying before the grand jury. But you have an individual who's kind of looking over this laptop screen, and I can't imagine that's any less intimidating than a digital recorder. In fact, I think the argument could be made that it's probably more intimidating to have somebody sitting on the end of the table with their laptop looking over at that particular witness. So again, but with that set of scenario or situation, I cannot recall any individual saying, coming into the grand jury, sitting down and seeing the note taker and saying, whoa, I didn't know this was someone was going to be recording or summarizing what I was testifying to. The cost, again, I know we've heard a little bit of testimony with regards to not knowing exactly what the cost is going to be, but at least my experience is that has to be saved. We initially have to train someone on that particular laptop that's provided by the county. That person has to become familiar with the workings of that laptop, how to save everything, how to then make sure that it's stored in the district attorney's office. So there's a bit of a learning curve and a bit of a process. I certainly would argue that a digital recording system would be less complicated, I think, than that procedure. The benefits for both as a prosecutor and as a defense attorney, I would just second what's been said. I think it would be very beneficial as a prosecutor to know, especially with domestic violence cases where you have victims who often recant. If they haven't recanted before coming to me, oftentimes after they've testified before the grand jury, because usually that happens relatively soon after the incident takes place. But then things change. And that's not with every case, but it does happen in quite a few cases. And that would be a very big benefit as a prosecutor for me, as I'm presenting the case to trial, and now she's testifying differently than what I knew that she testified to at the grand jury, where she was then cooperative with the prosecution. Now she's become cooperative with the defense or against the prosecutor. And I see that scenario and benefiting the prosecutor in a way to say, well, Ms. Jones, isn't it true that you testified in front of the grand jury and you said that he did punch you in the face? Now you're saying you fell down the stairs and the doorknob hit you. So that could be very beneficial with regards to not just the prosecution and also for the defense with regards to knowing what exactly took place. Because if, in fact, as a defense attorney, I get those notes, it's not going to have the detailed account of what actually took place or what she said before the grand jury when she was initially cooperative with the state. So there's benefits to both sides, and you can certainly see that as well with the defense attorney requesting information, especially when it comes to Senate Bill 825. I just want to barely get into that real quickly with regards to when I would have a client that would like to testify, and where this comes into play is in a self-defense type of situation where I will notify the defense attorney, I think this is an appropriate case if you would allow my client to testify before the grand jury to give his side of the story to explain this self-defense scenario. Again, that would be a benefit to the defense attorney and also to the prosecutor. So let's just I guess I'll go into Senate Bill 825 at this point. The benefit I see behind that is twofold, more just as much for the prosecution as it is for the defense. I've been in a position where I've asked several times, I've been denied. I've also asked several times, and it's been granted. And I've had several, at least four that I can think of, where I've had a client testify before the grand jury in Clackamas County, Washington County, where a lot of them were self-defense type related cases. One was in Marion County as well. And in each one of those occasions, most of them had to do with a self-defense type of scenario or situation. And the defense attorney, myself, you know, we strategize because it's not a decision that you want to take lightly, because you're kind of allowing your client to go before the grand jury where you're not allowed to be in that grand jury. You cannot participate in any of the questions. You're kind of just saying, okay, I can prepare you, but I don't know what the prosecutor is going to ask or what the grand jurors may ask you as well. But in those situations, at least the three I'm thinking of right now, Clackamas County, Washington, and here in Marion County, all three resulted in no true bills after my client was able to testify and to give their side of the story with regards to, again, these kind of self-defense types of situations and scenarios. In one particular case, the district attorney called me afterwards and said, hey, I'm glad, you know, it turned out great, and that was the best decision, you know, to proceed with that manner. So it is a benefit. It's also an opportunity. I had one prosecutor tell me that, hey, you bet, I would love to the opportunity to be able to get a crack at your client the first time, you know, and then and so that's an opportunity for them to cross-examine without me even being there to see what's going on. And so I think it's a situation where, as a defense attorney, it's very appropriate for some cases. And I think it's a big cost saver, too, especially for those cases where they resulted in a no true bill. I was able to present at least some evidence through my client to prevent more costly court appearances and more costly discovery and several court appearances down the road where eventually I could have get the information. If I can get it to the prosecutor as early as possible, that can save a lot of time, a lot of money, a lot of stress for everyone. So those are my thoughts.
All right. Thank you. And Jason?
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, my name is Steve Wax. I am currently the legal director of Oregon's New Innocence Project. I spent the previous 31 years as the federal defender here in Oregon. And before that, I spent 8 years practicing in New York State, 4 years as a prosecutor in Brooklyn, and 4 years in a smaller town upstate. I am here to support Senate Bill 822 and suggest that it is something that would be significant to the entire system of justice here in Oregon and would be a major improvement for the way in which our criminal justice system operates. I echo the experience that Mr. Ramsford explained he had in the District of Columbia, in Brooklyn, in the District Attorney's Office, presenting cases to the grand jury. The presence of a stenographer was of absolutely no moment. When I moved to Oregon now nearly 32 years ago, I was quite surprised to learn that the state system did not have recorded grand jury proceedings, and I've continued to scratch my head ever since. My experience in the grand jury was that the stenographers really just became part of the furniture in the same way that court reporters often do in a trial courtroom. I had no experience of any witness ever feeling intimidated by the presence of a court reporter, and am quite surprised at the notion that this bill would be opposed on that basis. In the last 6 months, in reviewing a large number of sex offense cases for the Innocence Project, I have been looking at video after video of recordings of victims or purported victims of sex crimes, And I don't see in those far more intrusive settings where there is a camera and the cameras are sometimes moved around that any of the victims have had any problem with that. In terms of the impact on grand jurors of having a stenographer there, again, it just makes no sense to me. My personal experience was that grand jurors who sit for more than one proceeding, I mean, they're called for a period, would often, you know, get into their roles and become active, and it doesn't seem to me that that is a legitimate concern. You know, as a trial prosecutor, I found the existence of the minutes, the transcript of the proceeding, quite helpful to have, not only for the reasons already mentioned, but also because the reality is there is sometimes transfer of cases from one prosecutor to another. Sometimes cases are not tried as quickly as we might like. And it's extremely helpful to have those transcripts available for witness preparation, both for the witness and as the prosecutor getting into a case that was initially handled by someone else. The actual transcript of a recording of testimony I have always found far more helpful than the typed reports of a police officer who took notes during an interview and then went back either that day or a few days later and typed up a police report. I would offer a couple of other thoughts just in terms of the administration of justice. In Oregon, as in most states, the grand jury is an arm of the court, and the judiciary has by statute a significant role in the operation of the grand jury. It seems to me that the way in which the grand jury is operating here in Oregon without a record being kept makes it far more difficult for the judges to carry out their obligation under the statute to ensure that the grand jury process is running effectively. In the same vein, the current statute, which permits the district attorney to ask to have the proceedings recorded if he or she thinks it's appropriate, is just another indication of the uneven playing field that currently exists. I think that it is a far better, you know, for the system as a whole if the recording is available to all in all cases, and I urge your support of the measure. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Senator Thatcher.
I guess Jason or whomever, since you are in the position of prosecutor, right? Okay. Were there, and it's my understanding that these written notes and typed notes aren't necessarily available to defense attorneys. Is that correct?
Well, there are some circumstances where they would be available.
Okay, but some, okay, but most of the time it's just to the,
right,
to the DAs or the prosecutors. Okay, so was there ever a time where those handwritten notes or the hand typed notes, as you were explaining, displayed a lack of clarity where a undesirable result was, excuse me, where it contributed to an undesirable result?
I can't think of a situation, but I have looked at those notes many times before, and all I know is that they're just not very detailed because it's just not a word-for-word you know, capillation of what took place and what was testified to. It's just notes. And in one particular case I had in Marion County, they were just handwritten notes. They weren't typed. And it was a perjury case where my client was being charged with not telling the truth in front of the grand jury. So very on-point case where I was able to retrieve the notes in that particular case. And they were one page where he testified for several minutes, but one page, very small, with just yes and no with certain questions. So in that particular case, I guess now it's coming to mind, that one wasn't very helpful. I don't think it was very helpful for those grand jurors who testified in that trial to look at those notes and it wouldn't be enough to refresh their recollection, and it wasn't helpful for me to know what my client said in front of that grand jury, because all I had was just a couple, two or three questions with a yes or no, and that was about it. And so it didn't give me an idea of what my client, in a perjury trial, where they're accusing him of lying in front of the grand jury, what exactly he said in front of that grand jury, and what exact questions were asked of him, and then what exactly he said in response to those questions. So as I'm thinking and talking, I am coming up with a scenario or a situation.
Okay. So lack of specificity, especially in that case, led to either didn't contribute to any helpful result, or
at least not for me.
Yeah.
No.
Okay.
No.
Mr. Chair, could I be permitted to comment on that same question?
Yes.
I think the perjury aspect is really important, and I can think of an example that involved an assault with intent to kill case that I was prosecuting. And several witnesses came in and provided an alibi for the defendant in that case, and I thought they were not telling the truth. And one of the classic ways of dealing with what is considered to be a false alibi defense is to go into great detail with each of the witnesses about exactly what was going on, and then have the differences in those various accounts pointed out as a way of showing that the people were lying. And in that particular case, I ended up indicting the witnesses who provide the alibi testimony and prosecuted them for perjury without having the transcript of what they said. I couldn't have done that because they would just change their testimony later on. So from a prosecution standpoint, I would also point out that having that transcript, having that recordation, is vitally important to pursuing that kind of a perjury prosecution. I don't see how it could be done, frankly, with the type of notes that we're talking about here. That would be exceedingly difficult. So I think that it is an important consideration to have that detail.
Any other questions? Gentlemen, thank you very much for coming forward. The next three, is it John Balbisio? Hopefully I didn't butcher that too much. Randall Cook and Christopher Masson?
Michon.
Who'd ever like to get started?
I'll go first. I'll start. Chair Pozanski, members of the committee, council. My name is Christopher Michon. I'm testifying in support of Senate Bill 822. I am a criminal defense attorney down in Medford, Oregon, but I'm not wearing my attorney hat today. I'm wearing my citizen hat. I graduated law school in 2005. In 2007, I served on a grand jury in Deschutes County. At that time, I was employed as a personal injury attorney. And I'm going to tell a couple stories about my experience as a grand juror, which I think were negative experiences. They were examples where the grand jury didn't function the way that it should have functioned. I think it was on the first day or second day, we heard evidence in a case, a couple witnesses. I don't think it was a huge case. Prosecutor left. We were working on the case, talking about it, and the prosecutor came back into the room and said, "How's it going? How are your deliberations going?" And I can be a fiery person at some points, and I said, "It's the law that you have to leave. You can't be in the room." And he ignored me and continued to inquire about how our deliberations were going. So I had to yell at him. I had to raise my voice and say, "It's not a joke. Get out of the room." At that point, he left the room. And I found it shocking that he had the audacity to just come into the room while we were supposed to be having private deliberations about a case. And the way it works in Deschutes County in 2007, I don't know if they have the same setup now that they did then. The prosecutor's office was in the courthouse. The grand jury room was in the basement. And there was a legal assistant from the prosecutor's office who was assigned just to do grand jury issues. And her desk was immediately next to the grand jury room, and there was a window where she could open the window. I don't know if she could hear everything that was happening in that room. It's hard to imagine that she couldn't hear it. And at one point, I don't know if we were being loud or talking about returning a not true bill, she opened the window, stuck her head into the grand jury room, and inquired how we were doing in our deliberations. And I told her the same thing I told the prosecutor. Close the window. This is a private process. And back then, that was 2007. I've been an attorney for a year and a half. I hadn't really mastered the evidence code. I don't think anybody really does. I'm much better at it now than I was then. And even with my rudimentary understanding of the evidence code, and for the members that don't know, generally how it works in grand jury is, with a few narrow exceptions, the same rules of evidence apply at grand jury. And the prosecutors continually elicited inadmissible evidence, especially hearsay evidence. And I would ask some questions about it, like from law school, can you really have that officer testify to what the other person said? And they really didn't seem to have any qualms about presenting evidence that would not be admissible at trial. But when it shifted the other way, there was a case, it was a restaurant, there was a theft. Who were the suspects? Everybody who had worked that shift. And one employee blamed another employee. And that employee, the informant employee, was the state's only witness at grand jury. And he testified to it. It was the other employee that stole the money. So once that witness finished testifying, I asked, well, did you receive any promises in exchange for your testimony today? Immunity, any other consideration? And the prosecutor, I knew him. He said, Chris, you can't ask that question. Go ask your boss. You cannot ask that question. And I said, well, isn't it the bias? He's like, you cannot ask that question. And in the end, I never asked that question because the prosecutor refused to let me ask it. I think it was a clearly relevant question. But the angriest anyone got at me, and it was more a quiet anger from a prosecutor, it was on a UUV case. We heard the evidence. We voted not true bill. He came back in and talked to us like he was a disappointed teacher or parents. We had let him down by returning a not true bill in the case. And we should really think hard about doing that ever again on a case. And at a similar lecture from another prosecutor, I don't think it was a not true bill. It was just a situation where we asked a lot of questions, asked to hear some more evidence before indicting somebody. And he really talked to us about we had a role in the system. Everybody gets an attorney. Everybody has a trial. 95% of people plead guilty anyway. Don't worry about grand jury too much. He didn't explicitly say it, but it was implied that we should not ask too many questions and just return true bills on most cases. Now, I've said a lot of negative things about the grand jury process and the Deschutes County District Attorney's Office. I know that was 3 DAs ago, so probably everybody involved is gone at this point. But we had a strong grand juror, and we pushed back. We understood what our role was. And it was an 8-week session. And by the end of that 8 weeks, I felt that the process was going very well. The prosecutors were not trying to introduce evidence that was inadmissible. We were not being lectured. They were presenting a lot more evidence. Once they had presented their planned slate of witnesses, they would ask if we, as the grand jury, wanted to hear from anybody else. And if we said that we did need more information, the prosecutor would set the case over and find those extra witnesses. And really, for me, that showed with a little bit of pushback that these prosecutors knew what the law was, they knew what their role was, and they knew the role of grand jury. And the oversight that we provided as a grand jury forced them to do their jobs correctly. And I think this bill would have that same effect in making sure that the grand jury process is fair and the role of the grand jury is understood as a check on the power of the prosecution, because I know that prosecutor who yelled at me and wouldn't let me ask a question that was relevant, would not have done that if that had been recorded. And that's what I have.
All right, thank you. Who'd like to go next?
I'll go next. Chair Prozanski, members of the committee, my name is John Valdivieso, and I'm testifying in support of Senate Bill 822. I'm a programmer from Portland, and in October 2012, I served on the Multnomah County Grand Jury Number 2 for 4 weeks. We heard somewhere between 75 and 100 cases. Primarily, they were drug offenses. And I served as the clerk, taking notes on all the cases that we heard. And I learned pretty quickly within a day or two that I had to choose between taking comprehensive notes that captured everything that was being said and actually understanding the details of the proceedings. So my notes pretty quickly became very terse, where I was trying to capture primarily the names of the witnesses and a few scant details that they presented. But that was about it. And as a programmer, I pretty much only write things by hand when I'm signing checks, since I type at a keyboard all day. My handwriting has devolved somewhat, and I'd be extremely embarrassed if my notes for any of the cases that I was recording were pulled and I had to decipher what they said. And I like to think that I'm not alone in that regard. So in my opinion, being able to hit record and then sit back and be able to truly listen to the testimony would be a major step forward in terms of both the quality of the record and also the attention that the clerk can pay to the proceedings. So on the grounds of creating a usable artifact from the grand jury, Senate Bill 822 is a good first step in approving what I found after my 4 weeks to be a rather imperfect system, sort of along the lines that Chris was mentioning. During my grand jury stint, I found the Multnomah County District, the deputy district attorneys presenting the cases to be extremely professional and ethical. However, in my opinion, the degree to which they were relied on to self-police themselves and self-police the entire grand jury process and shepherd us along through that, and the degree to which the grand jury's relationship with them was collaborative rather than skeptical, made it hard for me to justify the time it required of the citizens and the corresponding expense to their employers if the grand jury's role was truly to be a check on the power of the prosecution. So in the interest of greater transparency, I feel like this bill would help make these proceedings a more fair process.
Thank you. Randall?
Chair Polanski, members of the committee, my name is Randy Cook, and I'm testifying in support of Senate Bill 822. In April 2014, I was selected for grand jury duty in Marion County and was appointed by the impaneling judge to serve as the jury foreman. As an aside, like Chris, I am also an attorney. Unlike him, though, my specialization is employee benefits and executive compensation, which is about as far as you can get from criminal law and still call yourself an attorney. The reason I agreed to testify here today is that my experience in the grand jury left me feeling that the system as it operates now is broken, and I believe that recording grand jury proceedings would go a long way toward fixing that. There are a number of things that occurred during my service on the grand jury that seemed wrong. First, we were told by several of the prosecutors who appeared before us that if we were leaning toward a not true bill, we should consider returning the indictment to the prosecutor and let the prosecutor know where we thought the case was weak. As a result, during my 2 weeks on the grand jury, we did not return any not true bills, although several cases were pulled from us by the prosecutor before a vote. To be perfectly candid, that process bothered me. It felt like the relationship between the prosecutor and the grand jury was just too cozy. And I think if proceedings were recorded, there would be less of that relationship developing. The second thing that seemed wrong in the grand jury room was the nature of some of the evidence that was presented to the grand jurors. Although I've never practiced criminal law, I did take evidence in law school, and I passed the bar exam, and I know what hearsay is, and there's a lot of hearsay that was brought out in the grand jury room. In fact, I remember thinking to myself that there must be some sort of exception to the hearsay rule that applies to grand juries, because I went home that night and was speaking with my wife about it, and just it didn't make any sense to me. In addition to hearsay, there was other evidence presented to the grand jury that I know from my law school days would not be admissible at trial. During one case in particular, a police officer was giving testimony to the grand jury and said at one point that the accused had offered to take a lie detector to prove that he was telling the truth, and later changed his mind. And then the officer kind of smiled sheepishly at us and said, whoops, I guess I wasn't supposed to say that. And again, that's the kind of stuff I think that it wouldn't happen if there was recordings in the grand jury. It's my understanding there are several arguments that have been advanced in opposition to the grand jury recordings. I'd like to address two of those. The first is that assigning a grand juror the duty of operating a recorder would be cumbersome and would slow the process. I disagree with that. Although grand jury I served on had many cases and many witnesses per case, there was a lot of downtime in between each case. There's a reason there's lots of puzzles and books in the grand jury room to read, because you spend most of your time doing nothing. Switching out tapes or discs in between witnesses, I think, would not present any problem. Second argument that I believe has been put forward in opposition to grand jury recordings is that grand jurors may be less willing to question witnesses if they know they're being recorded. I disagree with that notion as well. The grand jurors that I served with fell into two categories, those who asked questions and those who didn't. And I think the reality is those who didn't ask questions were simply too shy to ask those questions, and I don't think that the fact that there is or is not a recorder would have any impact on that. I know it would have no impact on my questions. That's all I have. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Questions for the panel? Senator Thatcher.
So these handwritten notes that you did while you were deliberating as a grand jury, do you review those notes at all, or do you, to kind of try to refresh your memory on some of the things that were said?
So if I recall, most of the cases that we heard were fairly quick. A lot of them were involved a single witness, and so there was not really a need for that. There were a few occasions where we saw witnesses over multiple days. I think we might have looked at them briefly. I don't think they were hugely helpful. And I think the deputy DA presenting the case would kind of help remind us on the salient details of that particular case. They all started to run together after a couple weeks.
Gentlemen, thank you very much. Our next panel is going to be Gary Berlant, Catherine Call, Brad Caldwell, and Mark Logan. And if there's a chair that's free on the side over there, if you could pull that one over, that'd be great. Morning. Who would like to start?
Sure. Chair Brzezinski and committee, I'm Gary Berlant. I practice defense work down in Josephine County. I've also worked in Jackson County some. I've been asked to testify in support of Senate Bill 822, and I'll have a little bit on 825 also. I've been asked to describe some of the misuse and abuse that has gone on in the past, at least in the Josephine County grand jury system. It was about in the year of 2000 that defense attorneys found out that for approximately 10 years, all of the grand jury in Josephine County, they have separate grand juries for different categories of cases. So the grand juries that were put together for the child sex abuse cases, before they started their term, or at least as soon as they were picked out, a representative from the Children's Advocacy Center in Grants Pass would go in and give what turned out to be an indoctrination to the grand jurors, part of which was telling them that child victims of sex abuse do not lie, and they don't recant, that you can believe everything that they say and that they are testifying to. And they would come in before the session started, giving everyone that information. None of these people were listed as witnesses on the indictment, so we did not know about it for about 10 years. At one point, it was a nonprofit group, so at one point they published a newsletter quarterly or whatever, and in one of those newsletters, it said what some of the things they do, family, friends, and it said, and we go in and we instruct the grand jury about the process, and that brought that to light. And we then also found out that some in the drug cases, the task force that was doing all of those cases also would go in and give background information. So telling the grand jurors about different drug processes, manufacturing, methamphetamine, et cetera. So when the defense attorneys in the area found out about that, we filed a challenge to all of those indictments and to the process that really put everything in Josephine County on hold, actually for a number of years while that whole thing was sorted out. So it was determined ultimately by a visiting judge. Jackson County took over all of these cases, put everything to a standstill. It was determined that, especially in terms of the child sex abuse cases, that was completely improper because of the nature of what they were saying, just kind of prepping the testimony that you must believe these children. They do not lie. And all of those cases were ordered to be, those indictments were quashed. The state had leave to refile those if they wanted to. Another issue that came up not too many years ago, we found out that in many of the grand jury panels, they were returning indictments with fewer than seven people. So the statute calls for seven grand jury members. And if there were people who were sick on that day, the state would just proceed forward with them. And when that came to light, we also challenged that. Would either any of these things have changed by recording? I don't know. But it certainly would change the atmosphere in the grand jury setting, allow prosecutors to know that things are being observed, that there is some kind of oversight that is happening. You know, most of the time you have different DAs of different levels of experience who are taking things to the grand jury. And each of those present things in a different way. And I have had numerous friends who have served on grand juries, including the paralegal for our office. I've had some friends who have also been the presiding juror in them. And they have related how different DAs act very differently in them. Some are very respectful, some are overbearing. Those kind of things we would be able to see if it was recorded. And I can tell you, as a defense attorney, I think everything should be recorded. Every statement that law enforcement takes of any witness, of any victim, should be recorded. It makes my job so much easier. If I had recorded testimony from grand jury, that would allow me to have more clear conversations with my client. I'm constantly getting calls from witnesses or from victims who are telling me that I didn't say that, I didn't say this. Right? Or they're telling my client, oh no, that's not what I said, I didn't say that at all. And so they're coming to me, hey, this is what the testimony is going to be. If I could present to them, no, this is exactly what people are saying, it would make my job of negotiating, of client control, that much easier. Transparency is to everyone's benefit. So I'd also like to speak very briefly to Senate Bill 825. And in Josephine County, it is rare, if ever, that a defendant is allowed to testify. I have made numerous requests to allow my client to testify when they have wanted to do that. And in almost every case, it is denied. On rare occasions, my client is invited to testify. And most of those times, we would allow it. What I've seen is that is done when the prosecution feels like their case is weak. Feels like maybe there's something going on, and they don't want to be the ones to reject it and not file on it. They would rather submit it to the grand jury with my client testifying so that the grand jury says, not a true bill, and takes the heat off of them. So I think it would be a very valuable tool for me and my clients so that they can find justice more frequently.
Thank you. Who'd like to go next?
I can go next.
And if you can move the mic towards you. Thank you.
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, council, my name is Brad Kalbaugh. I'm here to speak in support of Senate Bill 822. I'm a public defender. I work in Multnomah County. I've been at the Multnomah Defenders Incorporated, MDI, office in Portland. My entire career as an attorney, been there about 7.5 years, doing felonies for about 5 years. I want to speak to the practical aspects of how I see the flaws in the grand jury system and how I believe those flaws would be fixed by the simple mechanism of recording what happens in those proceedings. There's basically three scenarios. One is you have the no evidence scenario. Two would be the smoking gun scenario, and then three would be the what happened in the grand jury scenario. So the no evidence scenario would be a simple fact pattern where you have a felony elude, where someone's in a high-speed chase with police officers, and during the course of that high-speed chase, they crash into some cars as they're fleeing through red lights and doing all sorts of mayhem driving around town. The case goes before the grand jury, and it comes back, and I'm presented with an indictment, and I have my police reports, and I'm comparing the indictment, the charges in the indictment, to the police reports, and I find on there a charge of an assault, assault three, or maybe also a felony hit and run where there's an injury to a person, and the name of the victim is listed on that charge on the indictment, but that person's name doesn't show up anywhere in the police reports, and I'm now left with, who is this person? How is there possibly an assault where I have nothing and the police reports about an injury? So I contact the prosecutor and I say, hey, I'm a little confused here. And you know, often there can be a delay in trying to get a hold of the prosecutor, whether it's phone tag or whatever, and my client is sitting in jail just waiting to find out what the basis for this charge is. And eventually I get a prosecutor who responds by saying, oh, so-and-so who is named in the police report brought one of their passengers in their car, and that person said they got really hurt. And I'm left with the prosecutor's assessment of what happened. And that's what I communicate with my client. And that's a very difficult case to resolve with a plea bargain or anything else, because my client says, well, why should we believe what he says? There's nothing else in there. There's nothing. No ambulance came. No statement to the police. Those are frustrating cases. The second scenario that happens often is the smoking gun scenario. I get a police report where there is there's testimony for maybe there was a punch thrown, or maybe there was a bottle thrown at someone, hit him in the head. And the police reports, a third-party witness says, hey, I was there. They tell the police officer, it just didn't look like, you know, the defendant was throwing the bottle at that person. It looked like it might have been an accident. And I see that as a defense lawyer and say, oh, well, that's helpful. That's interesting this got indicted. And I talk to the prosecutor about that, and the prosecutor says, oh, no. At grand jury, that person was very specific. They remembered your client saying, I'm going to hit you with this bottle. And I'm left with that scenario, which is another situation which is incredibly difficult to resolve. And when you compare that to a detective writing a report where they interview one of my clients, and my client confesses to whatever, and it's just in writing, as opposed to the videotape recording, I can guarantee you that the videotaped recording, or that detective recorded everything, or even if it's audio recorded, my client's in a much different position to say, well, I didn't say that. It just makes things resolve. Makes things resolve, and that's efficient for the whole system, because when I have to have an investigator try to contact witnesses who may or may not want to talk to my investigator, that's cost money, it costs time, and it drags a case on that may not need to drag out. And some of those cases do end up going to trial. The third scenario would be the what happened in the grand jury scenario, and that's when I get an indictment where there's charges of a burglary in the first degree, where someone entered someone else's home with the intent to commit a crime in that residence, in that dwelling. And when I look at the names of the witnesses who testified at grand jury, the person who owned the home isn't on that list. So I don't know how this charge was indicted. Is there a statement that's not in the discovery that someone says my client made, which is, oh, I'm not allowed to be here? Something along those lines to show that my client didn't have permission to be there, or that wasn't my client's home, or something else. I get it with those charges. You get it with unlawful use of a vehicle, where the person who owns the vehicle didn't testify at the grand jury, so now there's a question as to what happened, and those cases are hard to resolve. They will go to trial. The third, I guess, factual scenario is you get a case where there's a robbery, a third-degree robbery, which is someone stealing a candy bar from a Walmart and pushes past a security guard or loss prevention officer, and that's a robbery, and if you have the right criminal history, that can send you to prison for 30 months mandatory. You juxtapose that to the person just runs out of the store with a candy bar, doesn't touch anyone. That's a theft in the third degree, which is maximum 30-day jail sentence. They're very worlds apart. When I get a video, 7-Eleven has great videos. Walmart doesn't. And you look at the Walmart video, and it can be very difficult to tell what you're looking at. So you rely on, okay, well, what did the security guard say at the grand jury? Did he say the person was holding that candy bar when they ran past when he ran past him, when they pushed into him, because you can see the scuffle. Or does the security guard say, I don't know? Or did the person throw the candy bar down? You just can't tell in the video. And the prosecutor will sometimes say, I don't know. I wasn't the person who covered this grand jury. Or they'll say, I don't remember, or he didn't say anything about that. Let me call him. I tell you that I can try to contact them, but again, they don't have to talk to me. And often, I don't have a lot of luck with security guards and police officers wanting to make statements to my investigators. They usually would rather go through their prosecutor. Those cases become incredibly difficult to resolve, especially when you're talking about a disparity between 30 days jail and 30 months mandatory prison. So I think that a grand jury recording would just solve all of that, and it would be neat, and it would save a lot of time, and in this field, time is money. So thank you.
All right, thank you.
Good morning, Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee. My name is Catherine Call. I'm a deputy public defender with the Public Defender of Marion County. What I have to share with the committee this morning is a little bit different experience that I have than my colleagues with working with the district attorneys on what happened at grand jury. Because as my colleagues have testified this morning, one of the remedies available to them is to call the district attorney and ask what was said. And the response that my office receives in Marion County when we make those kind of calls is that we don't have to be told. And the reason I'm testifying today in support of Senate Bill 822 is because I don't think it's right or it's just for evidence to be kept secret from a criminal defendant or their defense counsel. Without recording any information revealed at grand jury, any information, even exculpatory information, is unknown to the defendant. And as I said, these prosecutors tell us that they don't have to disclose the information. There are cases in my experience where the defense attorney gets a mere glimpse into what happened at grand jury. And the letter that I believe the members of the committee have now is one sample of those types of cases in which we get a glimpse into the grand jury proceeding. And in this type of case, what I will receive, or what members of defense counsel in my office will receive, is a letter saying that the alleged victim made a statement that was inconsistent with what they told to the police. And as you can see, there's just a checkbox that said she lied. I can somewhat assume this means that she presented testimony that was exculpatory, that proved that my client was actually innocent of the crime that he was accused of. But I don't know what she said. I don't know in what manner she said that. I don't know who she was talking to when she said that. And I can't hold her accountable to that statement that now is showing that my client did not commit the crime that he was accused of. And while we receive these letters in many cases, this letter is actually a step up from the position that we are normally in when we have no notice at all that the victim has testified in some way that is actually exculpatory to our clients. For example, about a year ago, I had a felony trial. It started out as a misdemeanor, ended up going to grand jury before we had trial, and the prosecutor approached me in the hallway to let me know she had gone to grand jury, and she told me that her opinion after grand jury was that the victim, the alleged victim of this crime, was a liar, and a bad liar at that. And that's all she would tell me about the statements. From this, I can assume that her testifying and being labeled as a liar by the deputy district attorney means that she presented evidence that was exculpatory. This trial has been over now for over a year. I still don't know what testimony she presented at grand jury. That puts the criminal defense attorney in the position of having to prepare for a very serious trial, knowing that the most important witness has made a sworn statement, and knowing that I can't hold that witness accountable to her sworn word because I don't know what her sworn word is. And that puts my defendant, my client, in the position of deciding whether he should go to trial or not, without knowing what the evidence against him actually is. And it is very easy to forget, but in my opinion, essential to remember, that the decision as to whether or not to testify, whether or not to even have a trial or enter a guilty plea, is in the defendant's and the defendant's hands alone. The recording of grand jury would actually give a defendant the opportunity to make an informed choice. And what we've heard today is a lot of testimony from defense attorneys that believe that would be beneficial and cost-saving, because if a defendant was actually confronted and actually knew the evidence against them, there are a lot of cases that would mean we would not have as many trials, and we would be saving the judicial resources of those trials because the person actually understands and is confronted with the information against them. And as a defense attorney, my hope would also be that knowing and being able to negotiate with exculpatory information would help facilitate the negotiation process and overall reduce the amount of trials that we actually have. It's not fair for the practice of secret grand juries to continue. Evidence should not ever be a secret from a criminal defendant. And if hiding the truth from a criminal defendant is the only way that a prosecutor can secure a conviction, I would suggest that a conviction in such a case is not consistent with the ideals of American justice.
Thank you.
Mark? Good morning, Chair Przanski, members of the committee and counsel. I handed in some written version of my testimony, so I would invite you to review that as well. When I was 11 years old...
I need you to give me a name for the record.
Please. Oh, beg your pardon. Mark Cogan, C-O-G-A-N. I'm an attorney in private practice based in Portland, and I handle cases all throughout the state of Oregon, state court as well as federal court. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. When I was 11 years old, I had already decided to become a lawyer. It was about that time that my grandfather, a tradesman, was called on to serve on the Multnomah County Grand Jury. So naturally, I was curious about his experience. And despite his lack of a formal education, my grandfather easily saw the flaws of our grand jury system. He told me it was an utter waste of time for him and the other jurors. It did not take a formal education for my grandfather, a tradesman, to see what the grand jury was at that time and still remains a rubber stamp for the prosecutor. Moving forward, this is kind of a homecoming for me because 40 years ago, I was a student at the University of Oregon, and I worked here at the legislature as a page in the House of Representatives. I also followed up that service while I was at the University of Oregon as a student lobbyist, appeared before this legislature many times 4 decades ago, and I came to admire the dedicated and hardworking men and women who serve in our legislature. In particular, I became acquainted with legislators, including Ted Kulongoski, Dave Frohnmayer, Hardy Myers, just at the early beginnings of their careers. And I was impressed with their dedication to our state and bipartisan leadership. And back in those days, there was always one thing that always struck me about the Oregon way. And that is, Oregon stands for open government, transparency, and accountability. Those are longstanding values in our state. Government officials have always realized that they are accountable to our citizens. That was the age in which Oregon passed the open meetings laws, public records laws, following the wisdom that sunshine is the best disinfectant. Today, your committee is considering legislation, very important legislation, Senate Bill 822, 825, which would bring about long-needed reforms in Oregon's grand jury system. Finally, Oregon values of transparency and accountability will be applied to this vital part of our legal system. With the passage of these reforms, no longer will the grand jury simply serve as a rubber stamp for prosecutors. The grand jury will be restored to its vitally important role that it was designed to perform, which is an opportunity for members of our community to screen out cases that do not merit further prosecution. My remarks are primarily focused on Senate Bill 822, but I also have some things to say about Senate Bill 825. I have personally taken a very strong interest in this ever since I moved back to Oregon 18 years ago. I have been very keen about discussing this issue and the grand jury reform issues with legislators of all backgrounds, urban, rural, conservative, liberal. And what I have found is, from my interactions with your colleagues, is that this is not a liberal bill, this is not a conservative bill, this is not a Democratic bill, it's not a Republican bill. This is a bill that appeals to legislators of all political backgrounds. In fact, I've also met with my colleagues, attorneys throughout the state, and this is the by far the overwhelming feeling of attorneys that I've spoken with. Last week, for example, on Wednesday, I was invited to give a CLE program to the Jackson County Bar Association on the subject of grand jury reform. There were about 40 or 50 attorneys in that room, not all prosecutors, not all defense attorneys. In fact, I estimate that majority of those attorneys were not even in the criminal practice. And yet, the overwhelming feeling among my colleagues in Jackson County mirrored what I've found in the Portland area, that the time has arrived for grand jury reform. In fact, I could share with you that there was a prosecutor also who appeared at that CLE, and she presented the opinion that this would be costly, that there would be all kinds of administrative problems. The attorneys in that room found those claims to be insubstantial and exaggerated. In fact, one of the attorneys in that room, I don't know if he was a defense attorney or a civil practitioner, he said, well, why don't you just assign your staff member who's presenting the case to push the on button for the recording device? Indeed, they turn on the lights when they enter the room. Why can't they push a button to start the recording device? The cost and administrative burdens have been vastly over-exaggerated in this example. Now, passing these bills will advance the sound administration of justice in our state. No longer will prosecutors alone be able to dictate which cases should be indicted. I think we've heard some testimony from some of the attorneys or other former grand jury members who talked earlier this morning about how the process is sometimes manipulated. Sometimes the results are skewed by prosecutors who have an agenda. And as attorneys, we're advocates. As attorneys, we're accustomed to advocating for our client. And I don't fault prosecutors for being earnest and dedicated and passionate advocates for their cause. But the current system allows the prosecutors to not only be advocates for their cause, but also to dictate how the proceedings are run in the grand jury. That cannot continue. Once we have recording, there will be more transparency, there will be more accountability. Prosecutors will be on notice that they must conduct themselves correctly.
Mark, I need you to wrap up, please.
Okay, I will. Let me give some brief examples of.
I think we've had enough examples that have come. I've got another panel of opponents that have not had a time. We've now gone an hour and a half.
Oh, I beg
your
pardon.
So I need to give them some time. Thank you.
Okay. Well, you have my written remarks. I'll just rely on the rest of that for my testimony.
I appreciate that. Any questions? Thank you all very much for coming forward, and we will take your written testimony. It's all part of the record.
I appreciate that. Thank you for letting us appear.
You bet. So I'm going to go ahead and call Doug Martini, Doug Harkworld up, and leave that. You can just leave it wherever. Walt, I see you're in the room. I don't know if you wanted to come in. I know you came in late. Did you want to be part of this panel?
No, thank you.
Okay.
Chairman Przanski and members of the committee, I'm Doug Martini, and I'm here representing the Oregon District Attorneys Association. I'm also the District Attorney of Linn County and have been so for the last 2 years. I've been a prosecutor for the past 14, during which time I've conducted and presented evidence to grand juries in hundreds of instances. In fact, just within about a week ago, I presented a case before a grand jury as well. In addition to that experience, in Linn County, whenever a grand jury is impaneled, the presiding judge then turns over the grand jury to me, and I give an orientation to the grand jury. I explain grand jury laws to them and what the practices are. Appropriate grand jury laws and protocols and practices are good for Oregon, and we want to be part of a dialogue that helps to build respect for and faith in our system. And so we invite a more dedicated and thorough conversation into this area. This bill changes how we do business probably more than any other bill that's before the legislature this session. And so we're asking for careful consideration of any changes to our grand jury system. Similar bills have been proposed in the past, generally brought to us from the criminal defense bar. Those have been previously rejected. We appreciated the opportunity to meet with Senator Cruz, Representative Williamson, with regards to this bill. We've attempted to be positive participants in tackling the concerns that have been expressed here. Grand jury touches many groups besides just defense attorneys, prosecutors, or even the court, who also participated in our two approximately one-hour sessions. And so we believe that a meaningful work group will include other partners into the dialogue, such as the Association of Oregon Counties, Sheriff's Association, Police, the Chief of Police Association. Grand jury especially touches what we will term as sensitive witnesses, and we believe that folks that work with these sensitive witnesses need to be part of this discussion. Domestic violence victims many times are very hesitant to come to grand jury. I've had conversations with the director of CARDVA in my jurisdiction, who is the Center for Victims of Rape and Domestic Violence. Spoke to my own victim's advocate director about this bill as well, and she indicated to me that many times when a victim, domestic violence victim, receives a subpoena to come to grand jury, they're very hesitant to show up. But many times, once they are explained, once it is explained to them what the grand jury system is, and that the batterer won't be there, and that the batterer won't hear what she says, their comfort level rises, and many times they are more willing to show up in grand jury. Child abuse victims are also another set of sensitive witnesses for grand jury. Sometimes grand jury, and these are partners in our grand jury system, because sometimes grand jury will be conducted at a child advocacy center to provide a kind of a softer environment for children to testify. I've spoken to the head of the legislative committee for the Oregon Network of Child Abuse Intervention Centers. There are 21 centers in our state. They're very interested in also serving on a work group to discuss what would be a good approach, again, trying to have a system that works for everyone, what would be a good approach on how to handle when children have to testify. Victims of gang violence are also sensitive, a group of sensitive folks, because those folks are also very hesitant to testify and have what they say recorded about what gangs have been doing and the type of violence they've been doing. Two other subsets are child trafficking organizations or elder abuse. So we believe that a robust dialogue is essential to making sure that we come up with the best process on how to run a grand jury. And the voices of, of these sensitive witnesses, they need to be part of the work group. Their voices need to be heard. We, too, have looked at the practices throughout the nation, and we would invite an independent analysis of what's being done nationally. I think that would be helpful. We're finding, actually, in our review of what's happening nationally, a very diverse practice. Some states do record. Some states don't record, just like Oregon. Of the ones that do record, some of them don't use the grand jury system. In some states that do record, all kinds of hearsay is brought in, and so a case agent, a police officer, comes in and just basically reads police reports to grand juries. And so just to say that there's a grand jury recording system in X number of states doesn't tell the whole story, and so I think we should look at the pluses and minuses of grand jury recording systems and how they're done in each of those states. I know Mr. Harkerode is going to speak a little bit more about the fiscal, but I just want to touch on it briefly. We need to properly fund whatever recording system. If there's a recording system that's created, we need to properly fund it. So what will be done with these recordings? They're going to be created, stored. They need to be labeled so that we can retrieve them and distribute it to the defense and to the state for analysis. That's what attorneys do. And then we fight about and litigate those things, or we can use them at trial. Defense attorneys will absolutely have to listen to these statements of grand jury. When someone's accused of a crime and there is a recorded statement that has been made with regards to the crime, we believe it would be post-conviction relief if a defense attorney didn't listen to those statements. In 2014, in Multnomah County alone, there were 6,168 hours of grand jury, approximately that of grand jury, that was held. Statewide, we estimate about 31,000 hours of recordings annually that would be created. An initial conservative estimate of costs, we believe that annually it would be an expense of about $10 million. We believe that's very conservative because that doesn't include what I think will happen, which will be increased litigation costs with regards to grand jury process and demurs against indictments. Another thing that may also drive up costs is this. If a grand jury is recorded and then the recordings are turned over to defense counsel, we anticipate that there will be litigation where armchair quarterbacking of criticism of, well, the prosecutor shouldn't have asked this particular question, or maybe the grand jury asked a question that was inappropriate, and therefore we want to demur against the indictment. There will be incentive for me and other district attorneys to, if it turns into an armchair quarterbacking situation, to just simply move away from the grand jury system and seek preliminary hearings to present our cases. The reason for that would be is because you would avoid the armchair quarterbacking situation, and if they have a concern about evidence that's coming in, we would get that concern addressed right then. There are some items in the bill that cause us concern. We believe it's absolutely critical that the court would be responsible for creating and maintaining the recording. The grand jury is a court function, and an accurate record would be essential. The court uses paid professionals to create their recordings in a regular trial courtroom. From time to time, there will be mistakes made, or maybe the court recording isn't done correctly, but those are with professionals who have been trained in this. If you rotate through grand jurors, you're going to have even more mistakes, and I don't believe that's going to build confidence in the system. The description is given that it's just simply pushing a button, and then we can all move on, and it's that simple. I actually made that same argument to our judges because I wanted more court time so I could get sentencings and trials to occur more. And the concern back from the court was, well, we don't have enough staff to do that. And so I argued, well, can't you just walk over and hit the button and we can get going and we can do the sentencing or we can do whatever hearing. And I would invite you to ask the courts, is it as simple, if you're going to make this type of a recording, is it as simple as just walking over and pushing a button? And I submit that it's not. There are provisions when recordings get released with relative to true bill, not true bill, and also within true, not true bill, if it deals with a public servant. Sometimes there will be cases where we will present co-defendant cases before a grand jury that are heard at the same time. Possibly two would be indicted, one would not. So what would get released in those types of situations? Here's another situation. In Section 2, Subsection 1 of the bill, it indicates that all everything needs to be recorded absent your visit to the jail. Well, grand juries are investigative bodies. And one thing that they do, at least in my jurisdiction, every time that they meet, is they subpoena in some investigation business records that will come before the grand jury. Many times those business records, we don't even have a name of a suspect yet. And so how would we log and keep track of those? 2 weeks later, we may get the return on that subpoena that the grand jury has issued. Maybe it's a subpoena for an IP address, maybe dealing with child pornography. So how do we make sure that the recording of the event of getting those records gets matched up with the issuing of the subpoena? Later, maybe an investigation from the IP address, the physical address that we receive. Maybe we, 2 months later, we actually have an investigation that opens up where we have six different suspects. And it gets presented to a grand jury, a separate grand jury now, because we're two months down the road. And we, if we're going to record this and make sure all the recordings get to the proper location, the court or whoever maintains the recording will need to make sure to line all of those up, the issuing of the subpoena, the return of the subpoena, as well as the six suspects down the road. In conclusion, I get it that defense attorneys would like to have a copy of what all the witnesses will say before they walk into the courtroom. I would love to have the same from their witnesses as well. But remember, recordings are coming. And I know you've been tackling issues with regards to body cameras. I'm in a jurisdiction where two of my agencies have about five law enforcement agencies, but two of them already have body cameras on all of them. And we're dealing with a tsunami of recorded statements. And the defense attorneys are getting their recorded statements with those body cams. And that is the future, and that's where we're going. And so before we add another 34,000 hours annually of additional recorded statements, I think we need to consider the entire system, and that this may affect the system profoundly at no small cost. It's certainly worthy of an in-depth discussion that includes the partners that I mentioned, and so I respectfully request that you would put together a work group that would tackle this project, this very important project, and include the partners I mentioned. Thank you.
Thank you.
And if I may speak much more briefly about Senate Bill 825.
You're signed up. I apologize. Yes, Doug.
A few things as I considered this bill that I would sure like to see happen before something like this were to be going into law would be I'd want some more security for my grand jury room. I would want money to make sure that all the notices that would go out would get to the places where they need to go out. I'd want security also actually for the hallways around my grand jury. Grand juries are held in lots of different places. In court break rooms, I mentioned the advocacy centers, but many times it's in the DA's office itself. Let me just tell a couple of experiences that illustrate the concerns. I once tried a case where in a courtroom where there was a bailiff, the judge in his robe, and the defense attorney, and defense attorneys are very good at helping to sometimes be a calming influence on sometimes volatile defendants. Well, this defendant reached and grabbed a water pitcher, and it was one of the hard plastic ones, and turned around and clocked our bailiff aside the head. Had an assault too now, blood was everywhere. He was willing to do that with all those safety accoutrements around him. And so safety is absolutely a concern for me with regards to this bill. You strip away the bailiff, you strip away a judge, a defense attorney that can be a calming influence, and you put that person into my office in a pretty small, close quarters, I do have some safety concerns. We had another case once where we were indicting a gang member, and word got out when the grand jury was being held. That's generally kept confidential, but the word got out on that. We ended up with having gang members coming around, and they were trying to intimidate our witnesses who have to wait out in the hallway, which is a public place. So we bring in the police officers, witnesses also, to please go sit by the witnesses that are testifying. And then the gang members started walking back and forth in front of the windows outside the grand jury room, making faces and hand gestures that you can imagine. It was problematic for safety reasons when criminals or defendants, gang members sometimes, when they find out when and where grand jury is going to be held. I won't go into details, but I've had a stalking case as well where a stalker basically would use the court system to try to gain access to the victim over and over again. And wherever the stalker would go, he would make note of the women in the room. He sent me probably at least 100 letters, and in many of those letters he would identify my victim advocates that would come in and help out the victim in the courtroom. That's not someone I want to invite into my office if he wants to invoke his right to testify. A couple more side rails. The bill reads that the defendant shall be permitted to give any relevant evidence. Well, of course, defendants and prosecutors don't always agree on what is that relevant evidence. There's not a judge in the room to make those rulings. The language is very strong. It says that they shall be permitted to do this, and that's ripe for quite a bit of litigation. Additionally, the way it's written, it seems that all kinds of hearsay could come in under that clause. If the defendant believes that it's permitted, it shall be permitted, or it believes that it's relevant, then it shall be permitted. The opposite side is also a concern. It also reads that later that the DA can examine the witness, and I believe that would allow me to ask, the way it's worded, pretty much anything I want to. And I may want to then ask questions even beyond the scope. There's no side rails that limit my scope of questioning. And so the prevention or the lack of side rails going both directions is a concern for me on that one. And so I would mention, though, defendants do testify from time to time. I have allowed defendants to testify at times. I've had defense attorneys approach me. They alleviate my concerns with regards to safety concerns, and if the concerns are alleviated, I do welcome that. I want to present all the evidence before the grand jury that I can. Those are my concerns with the bill, and that's what I have to say on those. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. Just to let you know, we've got about 8 minutes, and I have two other witnesses that probably aren't going to take too much time. But if you could keep that in mind, please.
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, I'll do that. So now we're at grand jury today. There's seven grand jurors. They're all sitting up there, and you're the grand jurors. You need one more. You only have six. You each have a microphone in front of you.
Doug, you need to put your name
on. Oh, Doug Harkleroad. My apologies. I'm the retired Lane County District Attorney. I spent a whole year doing nothing but presenting cases to the grand jury, and the law hasn't changed since I was doing that. I've done literally thousands of cases in front of grand jury. So you're the grand jury. You've got seven members. You each have a microphone in front of you, so it's properly recorded. The witnesses have microphones, just as I have a microphone in front of me, so it's properly recorded. And you have a staff person responsible to make sure that this works properly. Why? Because if you're going to record in grand jury, you want it done right. Now, the flip side argument is, well, Chair Przanski today could push the button on the recorder, and he could listen to the testimony, and he could worry about whether or not it's actually going to be picked up or recorded or not. So my suggestion to you is, if you're going to record, if you decide that that's the appropriate thing to do around this state in grand jury, you need to do it right. You need to make sure that it is done right. There are, according to the Criminal Justice Commission, 25,000 cases in round figures of indictments every year, maybe 26. The court has some numbers that are a little higher. I asked David Factor to try to run a number two. But the point is, there is a huge volume of criminal cases that will need to be recorded if you don't restrict the kind of cases. And I heard testimony earlier saying everybody should be treated the same. So what does it take? What does it take to properly record 25,000 cases? A step back, and I know I only have about a minute left. The district attorneys, when we saw this bill, they assigned four elected district attorneys to participate, in addition to Mr. Martini, Rod Underhill, the Multnomah County District Attorney, Bob Herman, the president of the association, and the Washington County District Attorney, and Tim Callahan, a past president of the association, representing Harney County, a small county, because they all saw it as very important. They're all willing to play in this work group as much time as they can possibly give to make it go. I sent around Rod Underhill's staff's analysis of the cost associated with doing it right. And the beginning number is about $10 million. You can read that document for yourself, but it goes through, and it was done by staff analysis. It wasn't some DA. picking a number out of the air as to how it's going to cost to do this right. And so my message is do it right or don't do it at all. And doing it right, the idea that that you as a are my grand jury for the day are going to push buttons and then pay attention to what's actually being testified to, I'd suggest to you that that is not the way you should record grand jury. And because of your time constraints, I'll stop there, although I have a lot more I could talk about in grand jury. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. All right. Questions? Senator Burdick first.
Thank you. You mentioned a work group, but haven't you been invited to participate to this point in this legislation?
I'm going to let Doug talk about that.
As I mentioned, we were invited into a about a one-hour meeting a couple different times in Representative Williamson's office, and those have been helpful discussions. But again, we believe that this bill, more than any other bill before us, will change how we do business here in Oregon for the DAs. And so it's a big question, and I think it deserves a broad range of folks to have their voices heard on what is the best practice and a much more in-depth look at what is the best practice.
Mr. Chair, if I could follow up. We heard testimony from some of the proponents of this, that they had actually spent time in other states that did have recorded grand juries. Have either of you spent time in an actual recorded situation in your careers?
A recorded situation? A recorded situation, yes. Every time that I try a case, it's a recorded situation.
I'm sorry,
but
in
grand jury, I have not.
For the record, Doug Harkle wrote, yes. I filed many years ago. We were investigating an ex-county commissioner for official misconduct and perjury. And I filed a motion because I thought it ought to be recorded.
But you've never been in a state where it was policy?
Where it was a standard policy? No. But I have done it. And I thought that was your question.
I was trying to get at is the opponents, the proponents, we're arguing that people do not feel intimidated by the recording based on their experience, and yet you're arguing that they would be intimidated, but I'm just trying to see if you have any actual experience in that area.
Actually, I do have some of that experience, if I might, Chair Przanski and Senator Burdick. What I think is it depends on the witness as to whether or not they're intimidated or not. Young children having to use a microphone rather than just having the room wired and so it just all happens can be intimidated. Yes, but
that's true. They can. I'm just wondering if you've ever witnessed it personally in a recorded situation, and I'm not hearing that you have. I'm hearing that you think it might happen.
What I'm thinking about is child advocacy centers. As Chair Przanski knows, I'm the driving force behind a child advocacy center in Lane County, and we spent $30,000 wiring the rooms with cameras and microphones to make it completely unobtrusive for little children to, in essence, take their statements. And so I have a significant experience, not in a grand jury setting, but in a setting where we're trying to make it very, very comfortable for children to tell terrible, sordid stories about what happened to them. And it can be done if it's done right and the type of recording, both audio and visual, is done right.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
All right, Senator Thatcher.
Yeah, I guess I got a few questions. I'll just throw them out there, and maybe you can just get back to me later. But
let me just ask this.
Yeah.
I mean, if you got a lot of questions, is it going to be geared to one of them?
Yeah. Well, both. Either both. I don't care. But you mentioned, and I'm sorry I didn't catch your name, but you mentioned accuracy is important, and it seems like recordings would be more accurate than handwritten notes or typed notes even. And then you mentioned that recording, labeling, and storing and recalling these recordings would be burdensome, but what do you do with storing and recalling and labeling the notes that you have now? And it seems like with the security, there could be easily arranged, where you could have a secure location for a defendant to be even at a police station or a courtroom or something and do a television sort of review. It seems like maybe we could make, some sort of amendment for that. But anyway, those are my...
Yeah, so you may want to get back with Senator Thatcher.
Thank you.
I think her questions definitely are legit. There's a lot of stuff I could be throwing out here right now. I won't do that because of time. Senator Gelser.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm the non-attorney in the room, and I...
You're not the only non-attorney in the room.
Oh, but the rest of you look like attorneys.
Oh. We played the part.
You had mentioned in your testimony the nervousness that some victims might have if their testimony was recorded and was then heard by the defendant. I thought that defendants always had the right to hear the accusations from their accuser.
Absolutely.
If it moves beyond the grand jury to prosecute the case, doesn't that defendant then need to know what's been said? And why would that standard be different at a grand jury level for that defendant to know what's being said about her or him?
Absolutely. Defendants have the right to have their to confront the witnesses against them, and in this particular instance that I mentioned was a domestic violence victim. That's at the trial stage. We're still at the investigatory and in the whether or not we're going to make allegations against someone stage. Excuse me. That's what the grand jury stage is about. And in many instances, this domestic violence victim has already once made a statement to police officers. And in my jurisdiction, many times that's going to now be recorded because we have the body cameras in at least half of my agencies. And then we're asking this victim to come yet again and give us another recorded statement with regards to her significant other. Every time we ask a victim to do that, there's a burden placed on that victim. And we have a very robust discovery system here in Oregon. And so it's not as if there's no evidence to be presented to the defense attorneys. The police reports are going out there. And, of course, what I'm trying to mention is that we are getting lots of recordings of statements with these body cameras, and they will have those as well.
Thank you.
Thank you. Gentlemen, thank you very much.
Thank you.
I have two other witnesses that wanted to put something on the record, Kimberly McCall and Dave Factor.
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, I'm going to make my comments very brief. I'm just here to support ACLU's of Oregon's support of I'm Kimberly McCullough. I don't know if I said that. I'm here on behalf of ACLU of Oregon to support Senate Bills 822 and 825. The historical role of the grand jury, as reflected in the Fifth Amendment, is to provide an important check on prosecutorial power and the functioning of our criminal justice system in order to ensure that they actually fulfill that role. The ACLU's position is that there are certain minimum procedural safeguards that should be in place. That includes the right to appear as a witness by the defendant and the recording of grand jury proceedings. Ultimately, we see this as an issue of transparency and accountability, so we urge your support. Thank you.
Thank you. Dave.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is David Factor. I'm staff counsel with the Oregon Judicial Department. I'm here this morning to express some concerns about the role assigned to the courts as provided in Senate Bill 822 and explain the steps we believe courts would need to take to comply with the bill as drafted. We don't oppose the recording of grand jury proceedings. The bill as drafted provides that the presiding judge in each judicial district will ensure that grand jury proceedings are recorded verbatim. The bill, however, doesn't give the court the authority to record the grand jury proceedings. It instead directs the court to designate a citizen grand juror to record the proceedings. The bill does make the court responsible for storing the recordings and for managing and providing copies to persons identified as eligible to receive those recordings in the bill. This separation of functions from recording and then managing and distributing makes it difficult for the court to ensure the quality of the recording, the completeness of the recording, and difficult to then manage the recording and making copies for folks who are eligible under the bill. Under current law, Oregon courts though you've heard it said today that they're an arm of the grand jurors or they're an arm of the court. Some people say they're an arm of the DA. Under current Oregon law, at least, courts have really very limited interaction with grand jurors. We summons the grand jurors. We typically, as part of a larger jury pool in most jurisdictions, once selected and sworn, the grand jurors accompany the district attorney to review the presentation of cases made by the DA and to make decisions on whether to issue criminal indictments. In most cases, that's the end of the court involvement with the grand jurors, other than when their jury service is completed, we process their payroll and we pay them their $10 a day for their service. Grand jury proceedings occur outside the presence of the court and are managed by the district attorney. Grand juries, as you heard, are convened in about 50 different locations in our 36 counties. While most of those locations are in courthouses, they're not in parts of the building controlled by the court. Typically, they're in district attorney's offices. And sometimes you've heard that they're in off-site locations where there are no court staff to assist or to troubleshoot problems with the recording of proceedings. The preference of the OJD is that if grand jury proceedings are to be recorded, it become an obligation of the district attorney, and we manage it much like we do today with discovery of evidence in advance of trial. They have someone in the room who can monitor the recording process, can maintain the recordings for later distribution as permitted by the bill. As I said, that's sort of analogous to how we deal with discovery issues now. The courts would only be involved then when there's a dispute about providing a copy of the recording or whether or not there's a request to provide it to someone who's not identified in the bill as receiving a copy in every instance. Courts today don't manage the everyday process of providing discovery. We referee disputes. We sometimes set timelines for production and for production. But we don't become the repository for all things that may be subject to a future discovery request. We don't have or hold police reports, for example. The parties have an obligation to follow the law of discovery, and would have the same obligation here. If courts are given the obligation to ensure that all grand jury proceedings are recorded, our preference would be to have court staff in the grand jury room to do the recording. We know how to record court proceedings. We do it every day in every courtroom around the state. We have established training materials for our systems, templates for log notes, daily startup and ongoing monitoring protocols, and employ best practices to make sure that we get the best recording possible. If given the obligation to ensure all grand jury proceedings are recorded by a citizen grand juror, then we would ask the legislature to at least fund some time for court staff to provide training to that grand juror, to make sure that the equipment works and to be available to troubleshoot any problems. I will skip some of my other, in the interest of time, and just say that there is two main parts of the program as we see it, and it is a new program for the OJD at January 1, 2016. Effective date may not be possible. There's the providing of the recording equipment and the recording of the proceedings. There's also the managing of the records and the copying of the bills, copying of the proceedings to make available to others. We would be pleased to participate in any continuing work group. We have been involved with Representative Williamson in the work group to date. We look forward to continuing to work with sponsors on the development of the bill. I'd be happy to take any questions.
Questions. All right. Thank you very much. Here's where we're at. I'm going to be closing the public hearings on 8:22 and 8:25. Chair's asking those who want to be part of that work group to continue to work. I have to have stuff posted, and I will have posted these two bills by April 10th. That's the date that I have to have them posted for movement for April 21st. So these bills will be posted. So that's kind of, let's say, get together and start working on this, because based on the people I've saw today and the sense of members of this body, there's been a decision by people throughout this building that something needs to change and we need to do it sooner than later. So I encourage everyone to get to the table in good faith to work on this if you want to be a participant. If not, you'll see what comes out of the legislature. With that, we're going to be adjourned tomorrow. We start at 8 o'clock. Please be there about 5 minutes early so we will be able to accommodate our time. We'll be in room 50. We're adjourned.